Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for November 2nd, 2025, the cover story, I'm on fire. Testosterone is giving women back their sex drive, and then some. And then following this story, Don't Tread on Me. What Trump's war on sanctuary cities is really about. But first, I'm on fire. Testosterone is giving women back their sex drive and then some. There is no FDA-approved testosterone product for women. Insurance won't cover it. Many doctors won't prescribe it. It's become a cultural phenomenon. This article was written by Susan Dominus. Spend enough time speaking to women who are taking testosterone, specifically in very high doses, and you start to notice that they sound messianic. They're often talking fast and intensely. They're amped up. They're describing what they clearly consider a miracle drug, and they have no intention of lowering their dose, despite the unknown risks or some problems with facial hair. After all, how can they worry about facial hair when they feel so alive? It's nothing they can't take care of with a quick waxing, which they now have the energy to do at the end of the day, right after they prepare a high-protein dinner for their family and before they put the finishing touches on their spreadsheets, close their laptops, and light a few mood candles for the sex that they know will be great, maybe even better than the sex they had last night, even though they're a day older. It's changed my marriage, Jessica Medina, a 41-year-old marketing consultant in Orange County, California, told me. With four kids in the house and sex happening six times a week, up from, how about never, pre-testosterone, she had to put a lock on the bedroom door. She and her husband had attended a marriage growth group at church for years, but it took testosterone for their relationship to be, as she put it, 100 times closer. She was a little less emotional, a little less sentimental than she used to be, but she didn't have time for that kind of thing anyway. It's more like, get stuff done, handle business, work out, she said. In order to do all that and still have time for our kids and their sports, there's no time to whine about how hard it is. Catherine Lynn, a single mother who ran a bi-coastal fashion media company, went on testosterone in her early 40s to raise her energy. She got the boost she wanted, started lifting heavier weights, decided to pursue a degree in holistic nutrition, and enjoyed an unexpected side effect. She started having orgasms for the first time in years. Both Medina and Lynn are taking an amount of testosterone that's brought their levels higher than what women produce naturally at any point in their lifetimes. The way they and many women on these high doses talk about their relationships sometimes has the ring of romanticy. Fantastic tales of sexual rejuvenation and newfound intimacy. One woman in her 50s told me that after years of revulsion at so much as the thought of her husband's breath, she now looked forward to having sex with him almost every night. Even in the middle of sex, she said, she was thinking about the next time they could have sex. Another woman told me she'd had more orgasms in the past 2 years on testosterone than in the entirety of her previous life. A third said that after years of wanting to rip someone's face off if her husband so much as touched her, she now actively pursued sex with him. If anything, she now worried, she wanted it more often than he did. Just as estrogen is a crucial hormone for men, testosterone is an important hormone for women, instrumental in the development of bones, muscles, and sexual function. Testosterone peaks in women in their late teens and early 20s, then declines over time, so that by age 60 their levels have fallen by about half. Men start out in young adulthood with 10 times the testosterone of women, and their levels diminish much less steeply over time. With less available testosterone, women may have fewer erotic thoughts and less motivation to pursue sexual pleasure. Some of the mechanisms that make sex feel good can falter, such as the production of nitric oxide, a molecule that relaxes the muscles around the clitoris and allows for greater blood flow. For men experiencing the effects of low testosterone, low libido, low energy, loss of muscle mass, the FDA has approved more than 30 products since the 1950s, and yet, to this day, there is no FDA-approved testosterone cream, patch, pill, or shot for women, even though their testosterone levels fall far more precipitously than men's as they age. That drop doesn't necessarily predict the loss of libido, and there are many other factors that might be at play: fatigue, body image, a troubled relationship. But once other concerns have been ruled out, leading medical societies endorsed the use of testosterone in appropriate doses for postmenopausal women complaining of low libido. High-quality research has shown that testosterone can meaningfully revive sex drive when prescribed in doses that restore women to roughly the levels they had in their late 30s, what's often considered standard dosing. Even so, without FDA approval, many doctors won't prescribe or don't know how to prescribe testosterone to women, and if they do, insurance won't cover it. That hasn't stopped women from pursuing the hormone. Often turned away by mainstream OBGYNs, women in their 40s and beyond have sought out non-traditional venues that are happy to sell it to them. Med spas, longevity practices, wellness centers, and nutritionists, among others. Increasingly, women are being given doses much higher than what's standard, sometimes spending upward of $1,000 a year and risking unpleasant and possibly irreversible side effects to pursue a dramatic high. I see more and more of these places popping up because of all the hype around testosterone, says Stephanie Phobian, the director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health and the medical director of the Menopause Society. And a lot of them are giving women testosterone in doses that get them to levels that are normal in a man, but definitely not in a woman. Rhapsodic stories of sexual reawakening have spread on social media, where testosterone influencers share their experiences. "I went years with no sex drive," Marcella Hill, an influencer in Utah, confides in an Instagram post from 2022. After going on a high dose of testosterone that year, she said, she rediscovered her attraction to her husband. "My body would heat up just from him walking in the room." This season on The Real Housewives of Orange County, three of the show's stars described their testosterone regimens. Gretchen Rossi was shown baring her bottom as her doctor implanted beneath her skin a tiny but powerful pellet packed with crystalline testosterone that would be released over the course of about 4 months. She commented afterward that she had recently reduced her levels. "I had to take mine down because I was humping everything," she said. Rossi's co-star, Jennifer Pedratti, commiserated, "You'll just hump and hump and hump away." In group chats, at kids' soccer games, over drinks, words of testosterone's power has spread. Carrie Simpson, a 55-year-old in Gardnerville, Nevada, went on high-dose testosterone on the advice of a friend who promised it would help with her general fatigue. Right after she got her first dose, her family noticed that she was considerably more opinionated than usual and would argue her points with a fierce intensity. "My daughter told me at one point I was acting like a teenage boy," Simpson told me. The observation made sense, since Simpson's testosterone levels were approaching the range of a typical teenage boy's. "It's night and day," she said. "You're like, holy cow, a light bulb goes on, I'm on fire." Testosterone is the hormone most strongly linked to aggression and sex drive in males across the animal kingdom, writes Carol Hooven in her book, Tea, The Story of Testosterone, the hormone that dominates and divides us. Male song sparrows given extra testosterone abandon their usual nest-tending ways, spending more time singing to mark their territory and attracting new mates, sometimes leaving their newborn chicks to die of starvation. Female rats that are juiced with additional testosterone are more likely to bite and attack other rats while competing for food. Testosterone is thought to spike and drop in response to certain cues. Men's levels rise in competitive situations, but fall when they become fathers. The more time they spend with their newborns, the more their testosterone declines. How testosterone functions in women is not as well understood, but over the past several decades, a number of large trials of products, patches, creams, and gels, have shown that standard-dose testosterone improved women's desire, arousal, sexual responsiveness, and even self-image. Yet when the FDA had the opportunity to approve one of those products in 2004, a patch created by Procter & Gamble that raised the number of satisfying sexual encounters women reported by an average of one per month, it declined to do so, concluding that the uptick was not enough in the absence of longer-term safety studies, something the agency had not required for men. The finding of one a month was an average, points out Susan Davis, an endocrinologist at Monash University in Australia and a leading researcher on testosterone in women. Many women would have more. But even one additional satisfying sexual encounter for a woman who is currently having none could be world-changing, pleasure-delivering, confidence-building, couple-strengthening. Just removing the dread that so many women experience at the thought of sex with their partners might have justified approval. Several countries have come to that conclusion. Standard-dose testosterone cream for women has now been approved in Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom, where demands soared nearly 400% between 2019 and 2022. Right now, women in the United States who want to take standard-dose testosterone, typically 5 milligrams per day, first have to find a practitioner who will prescribe the hormone. Then they can buy, out of pocket, tubes of testosterone cream that are intended for men. Men are instructed to use the entire tube, while women have to estimate how much about one-tenth of the tube would be. Alternatively, they can pay more for a prescription that their doctor gives to a compounding pharmacy, which provides customized medications not regulated by the FDA to get dispensers that can dole out the proper amount. Hunting down a practitioner willing to prescribe testosterone can be a frustrating experience. Kimberly Solo, a 44-year-old therapist in Massachusetts, approached her OBGYN about taking testosterone because her libido was just gone, she told me. Her doctor refused, on the grounds that it wasn't FDA approved and that she was concerned about potential side effects. Eventually, Solo found her way to MIDI, a virtual care platform for middle-aged women that currently prescribes standard-dose testosterone in 12 states. It was amazing, Solo said. My sex drive returned. I wouldn't say that it has returned to its previous level, but it's not zero like it had been. Lindsay Lister, a dental hygienist from New York, had a similar experience. Two doctors ruled out testosterone before Lister found one who would prescribe it through a compounding pharmacy. She, too, described the revival of her libido as a return to how she felt earlier in her life. It wasn't an overwhelming experience, but she was more receptive to the idea of sex with her husband than she had felt in years. Medical societies officially recommend standard-dose testosterone only for postmenopausal women because most of the research has been conducted on that population, but many practitioners will offer it to premenopausal women whom they consider to be appropriate candidates. Some of those doctors start their patients below the standard dose to be extra cautious. Others are comfortable floating marginally higher than the guidelines recommend. But many women go on testosterone without ever having a real conversation with a doctor about the pros and cons. They come to it through dramatic stories they've heard from their friends or alluring ads they've seen online. And their first experience of their hormone is high dose, high impact, and highly unpredictable. Tui, a 47-year-old entrepreneur and mother of four in California, was in a state of exhaustion when she saw an ad on Instagram in 2022. It promised her more oomph, more desire, the promise of feeling like her best self. That September, she drove to see the doctor featured in the post, whose clinic was in Beverly Hills. The doctor anesthetized her left buttock, made a small incision, and implanted a pellet beneath her skin, which raised her testosterone level to more than three times that of an average 30-year-old woman. Tui asked to use her middle name to protect her family's privacy. Tui had spent most of her adult life building three financial services businesses with her husband. Originally too broke to pay for childcare, and then too accustomed to going it alone, she regularly hustled her way through 18-hour days to make her children's schedules work alongside her own. She had to force herself out of bed each morning and was so exhausted at the end of the day that her body ached. Within a few weeks of the pellet's testosterone emanating into her bloodstream, Tui noticed a difference in how she felt. It was not subtle. It was as if she had woken up with a second heart. She felt super oxygenated and light, desirous, energetic. She bounded out of bed in the morning, which had been her main goal, but she also realized that she'd started looking forward to sex with her husband at night. She used to buy lingerie just to speed him along. Now she was buying it for herself and found herself intrigued by racier pieces. After 20 years of rote sex, it felt like a job. She started regularly having orgasms during intercourse. Then around Christmas, she noticed something else. Shocking amounts of her hair were ending up on the shower floor. She realized she could see white patches on her scalp, and overall her hair had thinned. By around the 3-month mark, she'd lost almost half of it. Hair loss is one of the known side effects of high doses of testosterone. It's the inverse of the dilemma some men face when they try to avoid balding by using a popular drug that preserves their hair by altering their testosterone levels. They may find themselves with the youthful, full head of hair they longed for while struggling for the first time with low libido and erectile dysfunction. Tui discovered that there was no immediate way to stop her hair loss. Once a pellet has been implanted under the skin, it dissolves, and the procedure can't be reversed, points out Kathleen Jordan, the chief medical officer of MIDI, the telehealth provider. So, if you're experiencing side effects, there's nothing you can do about it until the pellet has run its course, which can typically take 3 to 4 months. Tui found a different doctor who put her on a lower dose once the pellet had run its course. The side effects of high-dose testosterone can make women feel less attractive just as they are feeling more desirous. While losing the hair on their heads, women can find hair growing, darker and in greater quantities, in places they don't desire it, such as above their lip or on their upper thighs. They can also develop acne. A small percentage of women on standard doses also report these symptoms, but they are milder and usually reversible. Over a long period of time, high doses of testosterone can thicken the vocal cords, which can make women's voices sound hoarse or deeper, and can enlarge the clitoris, a change that can be nearly imperceptible or dramatic enough to cause discomfort. One medical practice in Austin, Texas, that offers high-dose testosterone lists an enlarged clitoris as a common side effect on its website, but reassures patients that the practice also offers a surgical procedure to remedy it. Lisa Steinbach, whose OBGYN prescribed high-dose testosterone for fatigue and overall wellness after she had a hysterectomy, noticed no improvement in her energy or in her sex life, though that had never been an issue for her. But about a year into the treatment, she started sounding like someone who had a persistent cold. Her voice got worse over time. "It's very raspy," she said, "and people are always asking me, 'Oh, are you sick?' Or they think it's a man's voice." Steinbach decided to stop taking testosterone, but the raspiness did not go away. It remains a constant source of distress for her. Some women on high-dose testosterone experience a level of arousal so intense that they find it uncomfortable. Susan Davis, who has studied testosterone for decades, recalls one woman who came to her wanting to lower her dose. She had recently injured her back having sex with her husband in their car. She'd instructed him to pull over to the side of the road, unable to wait for relief. Tammy Nelson, a sex therapist in California, also found her level of arousal to be distractingly high. The testosterone made her so irritable, so easily annoyed, so frankly disgusted by the failures of mankind, and especially her own man, her husband, that she couldn't bring herself to have sex with him. "I wanted to have sex with my husband," she said. "I was just too pissed off at him to do it." It took Angie Kinnearum, a woman's health advocate who was taking a high dose of testosterone, several months of feeling uncontrolled rage toward her husband to realize that although her marriage was not perfect, it was the testosterone that was driving her fury. Women should be clearly informed of these possible side effects, says Rachel Rubin, a urologist who specializes in sexual medicine. But many of them tell Rubin they don't care. In fact, some women say they like the extra sensitivity that comes with a larger clitoris. She points out that hormonal birth control suppresses testosterone, so many women's clitorises are smaller than they would ordinarily be. "Testosterone is like a religion," she says. "People have strong feelings when it comes to testosterone." Little research exists on the long-term health risks for women taking such high doses for libido. "The fact is, we just don't know," says Kathleen Jordan of MIDI. "Trans men take testosterone in much higher doses than even the highest dose pellets and are not thought to be putting their health at risk," Rubin says. But she criticized the companies that produce pellets for failing to conduct long-term, gold standard studies on their own products. In February, the FDA began requiring all approved testosterone products for men to come with a warning label about the risks of high blood pressure. Doctors who are concerned about potential health risks sometimes find that they have a hard time persuading women to drop their levels once they've experienced a testosterone high. Jennifer Key, a writer in Oxford, Mississippi, went on high-dose testosterone about 5 years ago and found it both fascinating and alluring to feel, as she put it, like a teenage boy. "It was interesting to be like, oh, this is what people talk about when they talk about wanting sex and being into sex and missing sex," she said. Her doctor insisted that she lower her dose when she saw the levels Key was reaching. But that doesn't stop Key from trying to negotiate her way back to where she was. "I have a good magnifying mirror," she said. "I just pluck." Enthusiasm for testosterone cuts across political lines. Several of the women I interviewed belong to religious communities that strongly oppose gender-affirming care, and yet were taking testosterone in amounts comparable to those taken by some trans men. Marcella Hill, one of the most popular testosterone influencers on Instagram, was a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints when she first started experimenting with high-dose testosterone and proselytizing about its powers. Although she has since left the church, in part because of the way she says it shames women about their sexual desire, she has many friends still there who take high doses of the hormone. I'd never really sat with myself and thought about what I think about gender-affirming care, Hill said, but I think everyone should get to decide how they want to live in their body. President Trump's commissioner of the FDA, Martin McCary, has signaled his enthusiasm for hormone therapies for middle-aged women, and the company Marius Pharmaceuticals is in conversations with the agency about clinical trials it intends to start on a standard-dose testosterone pill for women. The conversations so far suggest that it won't be easy by any means, but I think the new FDA will be reasonable, said Marius's chief executive, Shaolin Shaw, which represents a step in the right direction. In the past, he said, the agency's response to hormones for postmenopausal women has generally been like running into a brick wall. The FDA declined to comment on its past decisions regarding testosterone, citing the government's shutdown. In July, McCary convened a panel on hormone therapy that included Kelly Casperson, a urologist with more than 400,000 followers on Instagram, who is a passionate advocate for making standard-dose testosterone available to women. Her support for an FDA-approved product is mainstream among doctors who specialize in menopausal care, but the promises that she makes about the hormone alarm some of her colleagues. When women go on testosterone, Casperson said on the panel, they start businesses. They report, she said, that their math skills improve. One woman told Casperson that she started suddenly remembering how to speak German, her first language. Although there are signals, Davis says, that standard-dose testosterone might benefit women's cognition, mood, and bone and muscle strength, the research is still not there. I just don't like women being promised things that haven't been proven true. Stephanie Fobian of the Mayo Clinic says she has seen a steep increase in the number of women coming into her office asking about testosterone, many of them expecting the kinds of unrealistic results, even from standard doses, that influencers on social media promise. It isn't an anti-aging drug, she said, and it won't make women want to have sex with their partner if there are communication issues and they no longer feel connected with their partner. The promises that some testosterone providers make about energy, strength, and mood have an obvious appeal in the current moment. Middle-aged women on both sides of the political spectrum feel underserved by mainstream medicine, and their social media feeds are full of offerings that promise them they can biohack or spend their way via GLP-1s, a cosmetic procedure, or supplements, to a more perfect self. Some of the women I interviewed were taking testosterone to try to save their marriages. Gotta keep them happy, as one of the Real Housewives put it. Others were desperate for energy as they tried to juggle the superhuman demands on all too many working mothers. But many were just trying to reclaim their desire. Women who are on testosterone, high or low, often sound as if they are in the midst of a new phase of sexual liberation. Tui, the business owner from California, is now on a dose of testosterone that's on the high end of what women in their 30s produce naturally. But she misses those megadose days when she would wake up every morning feeling as if she could take on the world, start a PhD, and explore her sex life. Very little of the hair that Tui lost has grown back. Would she do it again? Yes, 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 she said. Susan Dominus, who wrote this article, has been a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine since 2011. I would now like to take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Our next article is from the Ideas section of The New York Times Magazine, What Trump's War on Sanctuary Cities is Really About. A movement born in churches to help vulnerable immigrants has become a constitutional battleground in Chicago and Portland, Oregon. This article was written by Marcella Valdez. Donald J. Trump has been railing against sanctuary cities for a decade, describing them as hotbeds of crime and magnets for undocumented immigrants. Attacking them was a staple of both of his presidential campaigns. So it was hardly a surprise when he signed an executive order in April directing the Attorney General and the Homeland Security Secretary to pursue all necessary legal remedies and enforcement measures to force cities and states to implement federal immigration laws. A White House news release that accompanied the executive order quoted a note that the president posted on Truth Social a few weeks earlier. "No more sanctuary cities," he wrote. "They protect the criminals, not the victims. They are disgracing our country and are being mocked all over the world. Working on papers to withhold all federal funding for any city or state that allows these death traps to exist." In the 6 months since, we've learned what enforcement measures look like. Hundreds of officers from several federal agencies swarming city centers, apprehending unauthorized migrants, and sometimes American citizens, during raids and traffic stops. In June, this drama unfolded in Los Angeles. In August, in Washington, D.C. It's now happening in Chicago, and, pending court challenges, may happen in Portland, Oregon. More than 300 sanctuary jurisdictions exist in the United States, including those four cities and several entire states, according to the political scientist Lauren Collingwood and Benjamin Gonzalez O'Brien. Some have passed laws barring city employees from asking individuals about their immigration status. Others will not honor requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement to detain people unless they are suspected of violent crimes. The Trump administration's campaign to end sanctuary cities faces steep legal hurdles, but courts move slowly and the struggle over who is obligated to enforce immigration laws appears set to intensify quickly. On September 30th, when the president addressed hundreds of active duty generals and admirals in Virginia, he suggested that the military should use American cities as training grounds. He poured vitriol on Democratic-led cities and said that inner cities were a big part of war now. "It's the enemy from within," he said of civil disturbances, "and we have to handle it before it gets out of control." Trump is now maneuvering to deploy the Texas National Guard to both Chicago and Portland over the objections of their mayors and governors. In California, the temporary deployment of National Guard troops has been extended through January of 2026. The sanctuary movement to protect unauthorized migrants was born in 1981 as a Christian response to atrocities occurring in Central America. As Anne Crittenden notes in Sanctuary, her history of the movement, by the mid-1980s it had become the largest civil disobedience movement in the United States since the 1960s. It involved hundreds of churches, synagogues, and Quaker meeting houses, all trying to save political refugees by using the age-old power of religious sanctuary. The backbone of today's sanctuary movement is no longer a network of religious safe houses. It is, rather, a collection of laws and executive orders that block federal efforts to commandeer local resources. At its heart, the sanctuary movement is no longer only about immigration. It's about municipal governments retaining control over municipal matters in the face of federal pressure. In the 1980s, during the original sanctuary movement, conservatives championed states' rights to prevent Washington from pushing environmental or gun control policies with which they disagreed. Today, liberals are using the same constitutional principles to defend the existence of sanctuary cities. This shift is easy for casual observers to miss. In clashes with federal agents, protesters are more likely to brandish slogans like "Stop the raids" than "Protect states' rights." Yet, understanding this history brings Trump's desire to turn the military against Americans into sharper focus. Expelling unauthorized migrants is one top objective of his administration. Another is expanding the executive branch's authority. The effort to crush sanctuary jurisdictions furthers both agendas. It helps ICE catch more, quote-unquote, illegals, and it erodes the Constitution's checks on the power of the president. On March 24, 1982, the Reverend John Fife hung two banners in Spanish on the Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. "This is God's sanctuary for the oppressed of Central America," one read. The other expressed a plea, or a demand: "Immigration, do not profane the sanctuary." That same day, Fife held a news conference announcing the existence of a movement that had, until then, been a secret. Several months earlier, Fife, the Quaker rancher James Corbett, and several other American church members and activists had begun quietly transporting Central Americans into the United States and then hiding them in their homes or churches to shield them from deportation. For Fife and his friends, this was a moral mission. Thousands of men and women from El Salvador and Guatemala were arriving in the United States to escape torture and murder in their homelands. Once on U.S. soil, however, more than 90% of those who applied for asylum were rejected. Deported, they were handed directly back to the governments that had often marked them for death, with predictable results. By rejecting the petitions of these asylum seekers and portraying them as only economic migrants, American officials covered up the role that they had played in catalyzing the exodus. Between 1980 and 1992, the United States sent more than $4 billion to El Salvador, shoring up a series of regimes that killed at least 75,000 people and forcibly disappeared thousands more in a war against communists, labor organizers, the Catholic Church, and human rights advocates. The United States trained and equipped Salvadoran battalions that massacred entire villages and that sometimes set the bodies of women and girls on fire after raping them. The United States stopped sending direct military aid to Guatemala in 1977, but Washington continued to funnel hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to Guatemalan regimes that disappeared political dissidents and machine-gunned crowds of indigenous people who protested the theft of their land. Under these circumstances, the early leaders of the sanctuary movement became convinced that hiding unauthorized migrants was the only way to protect them from immigration officials determined to deport them, even when they faced near certain death at home. In disobeying federal laws, the sanctuary movement believed that it was acting in line with a higher Christian duty, so they created what they called a new underground railroad for Central Americans. Its tracks eventually stretched all over the country, from America's southern border to the northern reaches of Washington State and Vermont. Chicago emerged as a logistical hub. As the sanctuary movement grew, elected officials came under increasing pressure from religious leaders, immigration lawyers, and Latino Americans to extend protections beyond religious buildings. And in 1985, several cities, including Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, and Madison, Wisconsin, ended their active cooperation with federal immigration investigations or put out statements in support of sanctuary practices. By the early 1990s, the original purpose of the sanctuary movement had, in theory, been served. The United States slashed funding for military regimes in Central America, which subsequently ended their civil wars. Meanwhile, lawyers forced reforms in America's process for adjudicating asylum applications, and Congress created a new mechanism for protecting an entire class of immigrants in crisis, temporary protected status. For almost a decade, the sanctuary movement went dormant. Then, in the early 2000s, it awoke again. Failures in foreign policy and immigration policy combined with sanctuary protections to create a new kind of American city in the 21st century, one where a substantial portion of the residents lived in the United States peacefully but illegally. In 1990, some 3.5 million undocumented immigrants were living in the United States, according to the Pew Research Center. By 2007, that population had reached 12.2 million. Most of these immigrants were from Mexico, which has a long history of cross-border relations with the United States. But while the number of undocumented immigrants hailing from Mexico dropped after the economic crash of 2008, the number of Central Americans kept rising. The prolonged conflicts of the 1980s had left their countries with wrecked economies and corrupted institutions, fractures that deepened in the late 1990s when the United States ramped up deportations of convicted felons to the region. As gang violence boomed, so did the number of Central Americans moving to the United States. By 2023, according to the Pew Research Center, the United States hosted a record 14 million unauthorized migrants. They came from all over the world: India, Haiti, Venezuela, Cuba, Ukraine, China, Peru. But the biggest populations were from Mexico, El Salvador, and Guatemala. These demographic changes characterized the new sanctuary movement that appeared in the early 2000s. Where the movement of the 1980s aimed to protect political refugees through personal acts of civil disobedience, the new movement defended all unauthorized migrants by building a legal shield to protect state and local governments from federal coercion. The new leaders were often undocumented immigrants who had been living in the United States for decades, or their children. They were fighting to keep their families together in the face of more aggressive enforcement tactics used by the newly created Department of Homeland Security that targeted communities farther from the border. After foreign-born terrorists with expired visas crashed commercial jets into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, the federal government intensified efforts to curb unauthorized migration. Through initiatives like Secure Communities, the Priority Enforcement Program, and the 287G program, it tried to press city employees into service as a force multiplier for ICE. The idea was to have local police officers help identify, arrest, and hold migrants for the DHS. Some cities, however, now had practical reasons for not wanting their employees co-opted by federal agents. Local and federal interests are not always aligned, and administering a cosmopolitan jurisdiction with a large population of both legal and unauthorized immigrants is a complex matter. A priority for most city governments is public safety. To ensure it, they need their multinational residents to feel comfortable reporting crime to the police. This explains why even some mayors who seem fed up with unauthorized migration, like Eric Adams in New York City, continue to defend sanctuary policies. "I cannot have a city where parents are afraid to send their children to school or where children are sleeping on the streets, creating the potential for child exploitation and sex trafficking," Adams explained in written testimony submitted to Congress this March. "And if an undocumented individual witnesses a crime but is afraid to call 911 for fear of being turned over to federal authorities, criminals will roam free." Then there's the issue of money. Cities typically run on tight budgets, and accepting the burden of apprehending and holding migrants effectively shifts the cost of immigration enforcement to municipalities, eating into funds available for local priorities, like supporting schools. In New York City, according to a 2021 report by the comptroller, it costs about $1,500 a day to hold a person in jail. So as DHS tried to expand its reach into city governments after September 11th, many cities responded by passing more defensive laws. In their history, sanctuary cities, the politics of refuge, Collingwood and Gonzales O'Brien present Seattle as an instructive case. It had passed a City of Refuge resolution in 1986 and then retracted it. Then in 2003, the city passed an ordinance that forbade police officers from asking about anyone's immigration status unless there were grounds to suspect that the person was previously deported and had committed a felony. One reason listed in the ordinance was that, after September 11th, immigrants were afraid to access city benefits to which they were entitled for fear of being reported to immigration authorities. The 10th Amendment reserves for states all the powers that the Constitution does not delegate to the federal government. By enshrining the principle of shared state-federal sovereignty and making the states the default repository of power, the authors of the Constitution blocked the federal government from grabbing too much control, an issue important to colonial leaders still smarting from the tyranny of British monarchy. Since the 1970s, conservatives have usually been the ones to cite this amendment to argue that local governments cannot be forced to use their own resources to implement federal policy. In 1992, for example, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor pointed to the 10th Amendment when she struck down a federal law requiring states to either take ownership of radioactive waste or regulate it according to federal standards. Either type of federal action, she wrote, would commandeer state governments into the service of federal regulatory purposes and would for this reason be inconsistent with the Constitution's division of authority between federal and state governments. 5 years later, Justice Antonin Scalia also cited the 10th Amendment when the Supreme Court nullified a provision of the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act, which would have required local law enforcement to conduct background checks on gun purchasers. The federal government may neither issue directives requiring the states to address particular problems, nor command the state's officers or those of their political subdivisions to administer or enforce a federal regulatory program, Scalia wrote. But in the Trump era, the dynamic seems to have flipped. As federal actions in their cities grow increasingly bold and capricious, progressives are turning to the 10th Amendment's articulation of dual sovereignty in an attempt to create a bulwark against violations of the Constitution, especially breaches of the Fourth Amendment, protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. ICE now receives more money than any other law enforcement agency in the United States. Yet, its agents have never been required to meet the same legal standards for evidence that are required of police officers, nor have they been subject to the same types of civic oversight. Masked federal agents are now empowered to apprehend almost any person who speaks English with an accent. When ICE agents used battering rams to enter an apartment building in Denver, the New Yorker found their search warrant named no specific person to be apprehended. Anyone found inside was apparently a target. These problems do not affect only unauthorized migrants. The Cato Institute estimates that ICE requested that local police officers detain thousands of U.S. citizens over an 11-year period beginning in 2006. In this context, Chicago's new executive order barring federal agents from using city property as a staging area, processing location, or operations base for civil immigration enforcement can be read as an effort to block federal overreach. We will not tolerate ICE agents violating our residents' constitutional rights, nor will we allow the federal government to disregard our local authority, Mayor Brandon Johnson said at its signing. Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois has gone even further, arguing that the Trump administration is using immigration enforcement to create chaos and install a regular military presence inside Chicago. He wants to justify and normalize the presence of armed soldiers under his direct command, Pritzker said. The original sanctuary movement of the 1980s was ignited by a sense that the United States was violating its own laws and values. The new sanctuary movement of the early 2000s was fortified by the belief that the federal government was overstepping its authority. As President Trump pursues his attacks on sanctuary states and cities and his efforts to amass power in the Oval Office, Democrats may find themselves reaching more often for the arguments once employed by conservatives who championed states' rights. For better and for worse, throughout American history, these tools have proved their ability to frustrate Washington's plans. Marcela Valdez, who wrote this article, is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, writing primarily about the Latino and Latin American politics and culture. With the few moments we have remaining, I'll read to you now from the Ethicist column of this edition of the New York Times Magazine. As always, these ethical dilemmas, which are written in by readers, are responded to by Kwame Anthony Appiah, who teaches philosophy at NYU. A stressful family dynamic is weighing on me. My late parents named the younger of my two sisters as executor of their estate. As executor, my sister has not acted in the best interests of all three beneficiaries. She has paid herself exorbitantly, billed the estate for questionable work, and even compensated herself for attending our father's funeral and visiting our mother in her dementia facility. She gave herself first pick from our parents' art, silver, and jewelry. This was technically legal under the will since she balanced the appraised values. She has refused to provide requested information, including what she has paid herself. She also controls a separate family legal entity that owned a vacation home. She sold the house 16 months ago, but has withheld the proceeds, insisting my other sister and I sign a release, indemnifying her from any responsibility before any distribution. We have hired a lawyer. Each of us has grown children, and the cousins have always been close, but since all this began, there have been no family holidays or gatherings. My parents were good people, but poor communicators, conflict-averse and secretive. Reacting to that, I raised my children with openness and honesty. I've told them briefly what has happened. I made clear that their relationships with their aunt and uncle are their own choice and that I would attend any gathering they host, even if those two are present. Is there any credible argument that I should not have been honest with my children about their aunt and uncle's actions? And the ethicist responds, "Your letter serves as a cautionary reminder about the choice of executor. Grief can magnify old resentments, even fair decisions can look like favoritism, and questionable ones can tear families apart. So I'm sorry you found yourself in such a painful situation. Of course, I only have your account. If I spoke to your sister, I might have here a very different one, and it's worth pausing to consider how things might look from her side. A better understanding of her perspective might help you decide how to respond. That doesn't mean you were wrong to be candid with your children about what has happened. Honesty about family dynamics allows people to make their own judgments and act in accordance with their values. Your children have their own relationships with their aunt, uncle, and cousins, and as you recognize, they deserve the chance to navigate those ties without being forced to take sides. You can't undo the past or control your sister's choices, but you did well to try to show the integrity and openness you wish had governed your parents' estate. This, in families, is a kind of inheritance, too." And our next ethical dilemma, written in by a reader. "My best friend has been having an affair with a married man. Another close friend of mine considers the man's wife like a sister. My best friend confided in me more than a year ago. I was upset, but I stayed quiet partly because it didn't feel like my place to say something, and partly because I hoped it would end. It hasn't, and now I resent carrying the secret. If I tell that other friend, I risk my relationship with my best friend and may just shift the burden onto the other friend, who would then have to decide whether to reveal it and hurt the betrayed wife. But if I stay silent, I remain complicit in hiding something that could affect the wife's choices about her marriage. Do I keep protecting the secret or speak up? And the ethicist responds, many of us know far less about what goes on inside other people's marriages than we may think, how often the partners fight or forgive, what private understandings hold them together. Without that knowledge, any attempt to intervene is a shot in the dark. Even the modest goal of not making things worse assumes you can tell what worse would be. That's why it's often better, in these circumstances, to shift from thinking about outcomes to thinking about obligations. The question isn't, what will make things better, but, what do I owe and to whom? Here, your primary bond is with your best friend. You don't seem to know her lover's wife well, but your other close friend is loyal to her. When your best friend confided in you, it was under the seal of friendship. The keeping of confidences is an expectation that forms part of that moral contract. Telling others, especially someone likely to tell the wife, would be a serious betrayal, and you would become the source of a revelation that could hurt several people at once. You can think that the wife has a right to know what's going on without thinking that you have a duty to tell her. That duty lies with her husband, the person who broke his vows. Coldplay concerts aside, we generally don't go around exposing whatever instances of infidelity we come across. What you do owe is candor with your best friend. Encourage her to end the affair or to confront its consequences openly. If you decide in the end that you can't keep her confidence, let her know before you act. If you decide that silence is the lesser harm, then keep the secret fully. Confiding in your other friend wouldn't ease your burden. It would just spread the damage. Marriage is a serious moral institution. So is friendship. And sometimes, as here, they make conflicting claims on us. If you choose to speak, first tell your best friend why. Whether you choose silence or disclosure, let the decision be a considered one, rather than an act of avoidance under the guise of loyalty. And that is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.